Hey guys, this is the Vertical Guidance Podcast.
I'm Wyatt Fink.
And I'm Alex Danger.
And we're interviewing pilots from around the industry about their flight training experiences. And our goal is to make getting into the aviation industry easier by offering advice to people that are right on the edge of beginning their aviation journey.
So let's get into it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. This week on the Vertical Guidance Podcast, we're honored to have Rob Hagelin on. He's a retired Delta pilot. He has an absolutely incredible story about staying motivated and not staying complacent when you get to that dream job. Make sure you listen to this whole story. It's very fascinating, and enjoy this week's podcast. This week on the Vertical Guidance Podcast, we have Rob Hagelin. Welcome on, Rob.
Alex, nice to be with you guys today.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Usually how we start off is trying to get a little bit of background on you. So what kind of fueled your love for aviation? How'd you get started in it? And how'd you get to where you are today?
Well, it's a long story, 69 years long, but almost 69. But I guess my uncle was a Northwest pilot, so I got an interest through him when I was a kid. He used to take us up in his little airplane and let me take the controls. And so that gave me kind of my initial indoctrination into aviation. And so I got into skydiving. I thought it was pretty cool. So I kept skydiving for a little while, and that kind of fueled my interest in aviation again by just being in and out of airplanes. So I started taking lessons. And after that first lesson, I knew that's what I wanted to do for a career.
That's awesome. And when you were in high school, Rob, we were just talking about this before, you took a private pilot ground school kind of, right? And that's how you kind of started
aviation. I had the interest in high school, and there was at the VOTEC school, they were offering a ground school class to prep you for the private pilot written. And so my dad thought it might be kind of fun for myself and my brother and my dad, the three of us, to go take that course. But we weren't flying airplanes. We were just going to school and taking the course. And without the flying, it was hard to kind of connect the dots when it came to all the information, learning about the instruments, the attitude indicator, and the vertical gyros, and all the things that they talk about. It was an abstract. And so I just kind of lost interest and ended up flunking the test and kind of just said, I guess maybe flying's not for me. But then after the skydiving stint where I started getting into airplanes, I thought, this would really be fun. I think I'm going to go back and take a lesson. And so it was after that first lesson, I told my instructor when we got on the ground, I said, you're going to see a lot of me out here, because this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And that was my beginning of my sophomore year at St. Cloud.
So Rob, you were talking to us before, and you got all your ratings basically in 1 year, and I'm a senior now and I'm just finishing up on those ratings. How are you able to crank all those out in a year and keep yourself motivated on top of that?
Well, first of all, St. Cloud was just developing their minor and major program. So they had aviation courses that they were putting together to get that approved and accredited. So at the time that I was going through, they had an aero club with, I think, three or four Cessna 150s, a 172, and a Cherokee 180 that you could rent if you were a member of the club. And it was through those airplanes being that inexpensive that it was affordable to go out there and just give it a shot. And we didn't have to take the loans out that kids in college have to take now, because it's so much more expensive now to go through these programs. So you got to make a decision right up front and say, hey, is this what I want to do? And am I willing to put this kind of money out? Are my parents going to put this kind of money out for this kind of a career? When we were going through, you could rent an airplane for $6 an hour. You could get your whole private pilot's license for $800 or something.
That's so like three flights.
Yeah. So that was part of it, is it wasn't as expensive back then. And we were able to fly every day. every day that the weather allowed, I was at the airport flying. Sometimes I'd fly 2 lessons a day, and I was in the books constantly. So my motivation, once I started flying, was to be an airline pilot. And I knew to do that, I had to get all these ratings as quick as I could, and so that I could build time as fast as I could. And the only way that I could start building time was to get that instructor rating. So back then, we'd get your private license first. Then after that, you'd go for your commercial, then your instrument rating. And then somewhere in there, you'd throw your multi-engine rating in, which we had access to a Piper Aztec, which is what we used. And then right away, I got my flight instructor rating. So I got all of that in 1 year. And then the next year, I started instructing, and I was banking 100 hours a month. So by the time I graduated from college, I had 2,300 hours of time and over 1,000 hours of instructing, about 1,500 hours of instructing.
That's insane. And you also said you had 3 jobs while you were in your flight training, like a sushi chef, a tire mechanic, and worked at a ski shop.
Yeah, because the folks, they were kind of to pay for a lot of this. Back then, it wasn't as expensive. But my dad took the philosophy that I had to have skin in the game. So he said, if you pay for half of this, you know, we'll let you, I'll front the other half. So he paid for my tuition, but I had to pay for all of my housing, my food, my utilities expenses, and I paid for half of my flying. And in order to afford that, I had to work. So I worked 3 jobs initially to raise enough money, not only for my schooling, but also for my flying. So I had a job working at a tire recapping place where I would go in there after class and work till 5 o'clock. And I would work on these buffers and different things and doing the tires. And then as soon as 5 o'clock hit, I'd change into my chef uniform and run out to the David Supper Club. And I worked as one of the sous chefs out there and worked until they closed. And then on weekends, I worked at a ski shop, mounting bindings and selling skis and equipment. And somewhere in there, I still had to find time to study my classes, which suffered a lot, unfortunately.
I think that's absolutely wild. I mean, like, I get stressed out just trying to, but like, I didn't have a job in college and you had 3 and you finished all your ratings in a year. I think that's just crazy. I mean, that's awesome.
But you look at it too, is your program has evolved in such a better program than what we had available to us. So we were able to get our ratings, but we didn't have the skill set and the knowledge base that you guys are having coming out of college. You're fortunate that UND has a program that has aligned itself with building future airline pilots. And that's what they're doing. Is so they put you through a program. When you're done, you're going to be prepared for that airline. When I got done with my training at St. Cloud, sure, I was a flight instructor and I had that knowledge base, but not the skill set that you're going to have. You know, I never flew an autopilot. I never flew a flight director, used radar, any of that stuff until I got on with Delta Airlines. So that's something that you guys will have already behind you. You're already getting skill set working in some RJ trainers, if I'm not mistaken. So you're getting some of that already, which is great.
Yeah, it's definitely nice what they set us up for. So you were first jumping out of perfectly fine airplanes. Then you started to work on all your ratings. You got them done in a year. And then you got your CFI, you built your hours, you graduated. What next step did you take to go to? Did you go regionals or did you go straight Delta right after?
No, unfortunately, when I was in college, the airlines weren't hiring. So it was kind of a tough time because Northwest hadn't hired in 7 years. None of the airlines were hiring. So initially I was thinking of going into the Navy or the Air Force. I wanted to fly fighters. And then after I did that for a few years, then get out and go on with the airlines. But when I went and took the test and got accepted to the Navy, that was right when 1975 energy crisis, the very first energy crisis hit. And so I started talking to people that were in the military through some family contacts we had. And they said, now's not the time to come into the military because with the fuel allocations, we're barely staying current. We're hardly flying at all.
Jeez.
And so that kind of put a negative spin on that for me, especially since my end goal was to be an airline pilot. So I decided, well, I'll just stay out and do what I can to build my time until the airlines open up. So what I did is, there were no other jobs. You couldn't get freight jobs. At that time, it was kind of a catch-22 because you needed to get multi-engine time before a lot of these companies would even consider hiring you, even if you wanted to fly freight. But nobody would let you fly their twin-engine airplanes because you weren't qualified on their insurance. So what we did is there was another friend of mine that was an instructor there at St. Cloud Aviation because they allowed us to teach their primary commercial instrument and flight instructor students, but they wouldn't let us do any training in the multi-engine because we didn't have enough time. So we went down the road to one of the small airports down in Clear Lake, and we ended up talking to the owner there, and he had an Apache that he had sitting out there that hadn't been flown in a while, and he said that he would put an annual on it and let us instruct in it. So on weekends, when we weren't instructing at St. Cloud, we would go out to this other airport and grab the airplane, and we started teaching multi-engine and that gave us enough time in the multi-engine where then down the road we could start getting some other jobs. But initially, after I graduated from St. Cloud, the only jobs I could find were other instructing jobs. So I did that for about another, not quite a year. And a friend of mine, the one that went on that I told you about that instructed with me in that Apache, he went to Braniff. At the time, Braniff Airlines had a school where they were giving flight engineer ratings. And back then, when you got hired by an airline, you started out as a flight engineer. So if you had a flight engineer rating, that was a big extra in your qualifications. So most of the airlines at that time were hiring commercial pilots. I mean, not commercial pilots, but military pilots. And there was a big influx of retired or people coming out of Vietnam that were qualified, that were getting hired by the airlines. So if you were a civilian, it was rare to get hired by some of these airlines, especially Delta and Northwest and some of those. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to set yourself above and beyond the others, you had to get every rating you possibly could. So he went and got his flight engineer rating at Braniff, and right away got an interview from Braniff, and they hired him at 21 years old.
Nice.
And so that motivated me to do the same thing. So I went to Braniff. I sold my car to gain some money, took out a loan for some more, because most of the people at that school were military guys that were on the GI Bill. So they were able to get that school basically for nothing. And so if you were a civilian, you had to come up with, I think at the time the school cost $3,500. And so I was able to raise the money to go to the school, and went down to Dallas and spent a couple months down there going to their school and getting a flight engineer rating on a 727. So that was an interesting time, because in those days, if you were a civilian pilot, you didn't have a lot of background in complicated aircraft systems. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know anything about electrical systems, fuel systems, hydraulic systems, pneumatic systems, jet engines and compressors and 13-stage bypass valves and all that stuff. So, when I went to school at Braniff, all I had flown is Cessna 150s and 172s. And here are these guys are coming in flying KC-135s and A-4s and B-52s. And so they had all that experience. So it was a tough transition for me. So the only way I could compete was to lock myself in a room and just memorize the book. So I just kept reading over and over and over. And finally, after, you know, a number of times, it starts to sink in and you just start memorizing things. So at the end of the class with all these other guys, and there was, I think, two or three other civilians in the class, I ended up finishing number one in the class.
Nice.
But it was because I was so motivated to show that I could compete and could do it.
So you basically jumped from a Cessna 152 to a Boeing 727 then?
Yeah, exactly.
So you got the flight engineer job for 727, and then you just kind of work your way up the ranks then?
Well, I got the rating. I got the flight engineer
rating. Oh, you got the rating. Okay. Then what was after that?
So then after that, then some of the airlines started hiring, and I didn't have quite enough multi-time to where these airlines were interested in me. So I ended up, but I was flying skydivers on weekends before and after I went to Braniff, where I was able to get it some DC-3 time.
Nice.
So I wasn't typed in it. I didn't fly left seat, but I was able to get right seat time in it and had maybe 100 hours or something like that at DC-3 time. And so there was a company in Sarasota, Florida, that was an airline called Florida Airlines, and they flew DC-3s and Martin 404s. And so I got hired by them because of my experience in the DC-3. And then they trained me in the DC-3 as a co-pilot, and then sent me up to St. Simons Island, Georgia, where they had a base. And so I flew a co-pilot on the DC-3 and then also started flying the Martin 404. So I flew with that company for a year. We just flew round trips in and out of Atlanta to St. Simons Island every day, sometimes one, sometimes two trips. And I'd say about once a month, we had enough time where we'd sit for maybe 3 hours between the arrival and the return flight. And so I would jump in a cab and I'd take a ride over to the corporate office of Delta. Mm. And I would hand them in my updated resume and application, and I'd give it to the secretary. And I had my little commuter uniform on. And so I'd go back to the airport and fly back the passengers to Sarasota. And about a month later, I'd do the same thing again. And so every month they'd have the same application with about another 7,500 hours on it. And after a year's time, I think the secretary finally told her boss, says, "You got this kid coming in here that's you got to give him an interview." So when they finally wrote me a letter and invited me in for an interview, and I was walking down the hall with one of the personnel guys, he had my file with him, and it was about 2 inches thick. And he said, "Well, I guess you've been persistent here." So I said, "Yeah, I just, you don't know how long I've been waiting to meet you guys."
That's awesome. That's definitely a lot of persistence. And Delta, like, is known now, like, now is like one of the best companies to work for. According to like Forbes, it was like the top 100 companies to work for like any company. Was it like that back when you were joining? It was like one of those top tier companies to work for?
No, it was known in the industry as, by a lot of pilots, even other airline pilots, because my uncle was with Northwest at the time, and he told me that Delta was probably the best to get hired by. And I was living in Minnesota, or from Minnesota rather, living in Georgia at the time, but I kind of had my eye on Northwest. And the reason was because I knew Northwest hadn't hired pilots for 7 years. So once they started hiring, if I could get in that first cadre of new hires, I would have that 7 year gap between myself and the next pilot. So, and I was only 24, 25 years old at the time. So I would have had a great spot on their seniority list, and they had a Minneapolis base. So I was kind of looking at both of those things as why I was looking at Northwest. But since they weren't hiring, you know, back then you just put your application with every airline, because if you were lucky enough to get on with an airline, it didn't matter who it was, you would take them, because as a civilian, especially, it was very, very competitive.
So it seemed like just pilots in your day, Rob, were just built different than nowadays, because I mean, we have it pretty easy compared to like you guys. I mean, I know there was a shift. We actually talked about this in a CFI meeting yesterday. There's been a shift from the airlines hiring military pilots to the airlines hiring pilots that went to universities. But man, you had to grind. I mean, like, you're getting your CFI rating at St. Cloud and then going down to Florida and flying DC-3s for a few years and then finally getting hired by Delta. But what made you motivated through just going through that whole process?
Well, what motivated me was I just love flying. And if you don't love what you're going to do, then you probably shouldn't be doing it. If you're looking at aviation as a career just because you think it's going to be a financial windfall for you, I think you're looking at it for the wrong reasons. My motivation was I love to fly, and I love the lifestyle of the airline career. I love the fact that when you come home from work, you don't take your work home from the office. So when you're home with your family. You don't have to think about work unless it's that time of the year where you're getting ready for your recurrent training or something like that. But for the most part, your life is your own when you're off work. And you've got many days in a row off, which aren't vacation time. So that's another benefit for the airline career.
Okay, awesome. So how long were you at Delta then?
Well, I'm one of these few guys that I've got a pretty unusual career history. I started with Delta when I was 25, got hired, and I worked there for 27 years. And in that 27 years, at the end of the 27 years, I was a 777 captain, 52 years old, and I was number 50 on the seniority list out of 13,000. So I had the world by the tail. You know, I had everything going for me. But at that time, was very competitive in the airline industry with a lot of upstart airlines. It was after 9/11, and the economy was starting to go through some tough times. And the airlines were going through tough times where these companies started going through bankruptcies. And that's when Delta and Northwest were threatening bankruptcy at the same time. And I was in a position with other guys in my age that had been with the company at least 25 years. You had to be at least 50 years old. You had to have been with the company at least 25 years. And you could always retire if you met those two objectives. Or those two metrics, rather. And if you were under 60 years old, for every year younger than 60, you took a hit on that retirement. You took a 3% loss of your retirement for every year younger than 60. So we had to look at it, is it worth taking a risk that Delta might, through this bankruptcy, might not even survive? They might go bankrupt and liquidate. And we would be left without a pension. We'd be on the street with 10, 12, 13,000 other pilots looking for a job at 52 years old. So most of the guys in my situation elected to take an early retirement, even though we took a penalty by going early. Delta had an option in their retirement where you could take half of that retirement in a lump sum. So we could get that lump sum and we could retire and start over someplace else. So that's what, I think there are probably 500 or 1,000 guys, something like that, that did that over a period of a year. And so I retired and ended up getting a job right away with JetBlue. So I started at JetBlue flying out of New York as a co-pilot on the 320. Mm-hmm. And I worked for them for about a year and a half, and then I was getting a little tired of commuting to New York, flying the red eyes all nighters from the West Coast to the East Coast, and commuting to Minneapolis. And so I was sitting in the gate one night getting ready from Kennedy to fly back to Minneapolis. And there was another JetBlue pilot there that was talking to me about a new airline that's starting up, going to be based in Minneapolis. And they haven't hired captains yet. They're going to hire captains off the street. And they're going to be called Compass Airlines. So I went and interviewed with Compass and got hired as a captain on their Embraer. Nice. And so I took that job thinking, well, you know, I only have a few years before I retire anyway. This, the pay is about the same. I can fly captain. I can be home. I don't have to commute. And so I ended up going to Compass. Well, Compass had a deal with Northwest that if Northwest ever hired, they would take the first so many pilots from Compass in each class. Well, when Delta and Northwest merged, that agreement stayed with the company. And so when Delta started hiring pilots again, I got hired as a new hire pilot as a DC-9 co-pilot with Delta. So I ended up working my way up in my second career with Delta, where I went from DC-9 to an MD-80, MD-90 co-pilot, and then eventually checked out as captain again on the MD-90, MD-80, and retired the second time with Delta as an MD-90 captain.
Wow. Just did a full loop back. So there's like so many like ups and downs in your career. You had like the 1975 Energy, 9/11, 2008, going to different companies and like coming back. I know like recently with this whole COVID-19 thing, we've had like lots of people, lots of friends saying, oh, is the airlines for me? I don't know this downturn, if they're going to be hiring. Like, how do you work past these downtimes? Like, obviously there's some really low times in the airlines.
Well, the airlines have always had that ebb and flow where they, you'll have massive hiring where they're looking for pilots, advertising in the newspapers. I know when my uncle got hired, they were advertising for, you know, a few hundred hour pilots. All you had to do is have a commercial license and they'd hire you. When I got hired, you know, you were competing against all these military guys. And as a civilian, you had to have at least, you know, 3,500 hours and a lot of experience. So it's always going to go through those changes based on the economy of our country. You know, when things go bad, the airlines are one of the first ones hit. So you just have to know that going into it and be willing to put up with that. So some of the airlines prepare for it a little better than others. That's one thing I do like about Delta. Mm-hmm. They have furloughed in the past, but it's a last resort, and they typically are prepared for it. Whereas some of the airlines, I don't know how it is now with American, United, some of these others, but in the past, they were always notorious for hiring gangbusters in the good times and overstaffing. And then when the bad times hit, they would furlough hundreds of people on, they'd be on the street and they didn't care about it. Whereas Delta, when I got hired, right before I got hired, they had a downturn, but instead of furloughing those pilots, they reassigned them to other jobs in Delta, where they would work on the ramp or they would do some other things. So they were still getting a paycheck. They were still working for Delta. And they knew as soon as the times started improving, they'd be right back in the cockpit. Mm-hmm. And even when the other, at other times when things would start going bad, Delta would, they would overstaff and cut everybody's hours back before furloughing pilots. So the other pilots, the whole pilot group as a whole would agree, well, instead of flying our 85 hours or 83 hours or 80 hours, whatever it was at that time, we'll cut back another 5 hours. We'll only fly 75 hours a month so that we don't have to furlough these guys. Mm-hmm. Or when they did have to furlough, they would provide benefits to those guys on furlough where they would make sure that they would get their medical benefits and some other incentives where the mainline pilots that didn't get furloughed, they would sacrifice a little bit and contribute to some of those funds. So those guys would have a little bit of support. So that's kind of why I, you know, I'm not, I don't want to continue to push Delta, but for me, that was a big thing to be with a company that had that management employee kind of a relationship.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I know one of the big downturns was 9/11. It was very different from like energy crisis and COVID and other things like that. Did you know right when 9/11 happened that it was going to completely change aviation?
Yeah, because when 9/11 hit, I was in the training department. I was instructing on the 737, and I was in Atlanta, and we just done our 2-hour brief before the period started. And I went upstairs to the office to get the paperwork for the simulator period. And as I walked into the office to print off the flight plan and everything, I saw everybody congregated in front of the television, and they were watching the Twin Towers get hit and go down. And so as soon as that happened, we knew that this wasn't just a random thing. And this was an attack on our country and also the airline industry in particular. So we knew it was going to impact the aviation for sure.
So did 9/11 have a major, obviously you were pretty high up at Delta at this point. Did 9/11 have a major impact on your career?
Not on my career, because I was a senior enough where I was in, like I said, I was in the training department. So I just continued to do that. We did end up having to cut back, obviously, like a lot of the airlines did. But the economy, it definitely impacted the airlines. Then they went to some cost-saving measures and some other things to try to mitigate that.
So I know there are a lot of like downs and ups in the airlines. And as like us younger pilots, when we're going into like some airline, we're going to be super low in the seniority. So we're going to be like most likely the first ones get booted. Is it smart to keep yourself diverse, or do you just keep on plugging away and looking for different jobs in aviation? If you understand that question.
Well, yeah. I think you should always have a backup. I mean, that's why I had a business degree. Because I always thought, you know, if maybe I don't pass the physical going into it, you know, I wanted to have a backup. Even when I was in my career, we haven't even discussed, you know, how do you stay motivated in your career as you evolve? But I think it's prudent in whatever career you are, you always have some backups, because something, you know, life happens and things change.
Sweet. So yeah, that was actually going to be our next question. So like you got hired at Delta at a pretty young age. How did you move forward in your career within the company to avoid complacency?
Well, I think that was a factor for me. When I started out flying, like we discussed earlier, it was a lot of studying, a lot of work, and each rating was a goal in itself. And then you would move on to the next goal. So you always had something you were working towards. Once you get hired with the airlines and you make it through your initial training period for whatever airplane you're going to be flying, all of a sudden now you're in a time in your life where you don't have a goal anymore. You don't have all that studying you're doing. So how do you fuel and feed that need to have something to work towards? So what I did, I went back to school and got an MBA. So that was something that I worked on. I got involved in the training department and got into instructing. I worked as a line check airman in the company for a number of different airplanes. I worked, we had, if you wanted to be instructor with Delta in the training department, part of that process after you're selected is you go through a program where you or a school where you learn how to be a good instructor. So I worked in that department as well for a while. And if you have interest in other things, mine was instructing. I have always enjoyed teaching. So mm-hmm. that was kind of where I went off to. But other people, they wanted to get to management. They want to get into maybe the chief pilot's office. They become an aide or assistant chief pilot, then a chief pilot, and eventually make your way up into middle and senior management. A lot of guys do that. Some people get involved with the union. ALPA has a lot of different things you can channel yourself into the safety department. I have one friend that got involved with the fatigue aspect of our schedules and flying off the backside of the clock and how that impacts your body and your alertness while you're working. So he's done a lot of work with that and studies and different things. So there's so many ways that you can get involved with a lot of different things in the airline industry itself. If you want to do something on the side that's not even industry related, a lot of guys do that because you have enough time off where you can have business on the side. I know guys that, a lot of guys that had different businesses, or they get involved with another airplane in general aviation, mm-hmm. or they might go back to school. I knew one guy that became a judge. Another guy became a doctor, you know, so you have guys that do different things besides flying.
Wow. Yeah, I know. You're honestly like a great example for a lot of these, like there's new pathway programs that come up a lot here at UND where you can find yourself at United or Delta or any of these larger companies like 2-3 years after graduating. And when people come to the University of North Dakota or any university or training for flying, they're like Delta or United or American or any of these big name companies, that's like the end goal. So hitting that end goal like so quickly after college, I feel like a big thing is complacency. So that's like good to know to get involved that to stop right. that complacency.
Exactly. And there's, you don't have to be complacent because there's so many avenues that you can get involved in, airline related or not. And if you're one of those that are just satisfied and all you want to do is enjoy your time off and go skiing or hang out with the family and do whatever, you know, that's fine too. But every individual is different in their motivation and what they want to get out of their life. You know, life is short, so take each day and get the most out of it. Don't right. waste it. You know, I look back at now at when I started at 25 years old and the passengers would get on the airplane and look at me and ask me if I even had a driver's license. And all of a sudden now, you know, a few years later, I'm retired and it went by in a blink of an eye. So just enjoy the ride.
Wow, that's crazy. And then you're talking about being involved in Delta, being like a line instructor, other things like that. Does that kind of secure a job there at Delta rather than just being a pilot?
No, once you're on the seniority list, unless you screw something up badly, you're there for the duration until you retire.
Okay.
You don't have to do anything else.
So seniority numbers are pretty huge then.
It's all about seniority. So you get a seniority and even a month or two can make a big difference because you might have a guy that got hired 2 classes ahead of you and he's been flying captain forever and you haven't been able to fly captain for years just because they stopped hiring when they did. So if you can get that seniority number as soon as possible, that's kind of the big objective when it comes to an airline career. It's all about that seniority number.
Awesome. So we touched on this a little bit earlier, but I know we were talking about this last week, Rob, how UND's flight training is pretty intense and how that would train or like translate to airline training. So do you think that UND's 141 flight training is more beneficial than potentially part 61 training, kind of like we were talking about before?
Yeah. And, you know, we touched on that earlier. You guys are very blessed to have the quality of training that you have because you can get it. Once you finally get into the airlines, you're going to be ready for those schools. Where the guys that just the normal 61 school, they're going to get fed with a fire hose. the Delta, and not just Delta, but the other airlines, the way they'd handle their training departments now is a lot different than when I got hired. When I first got hired, it was tough. I mean, when you go through those initial schools, you are for the month and a half, depending on how long the school is, all you do is study. You're in either in the classroom or you're reading or you're looking at flashcards. Even when you're eating, when I go out for dinner, I've got a set of flashcards I'm going through while I'm eating my dinner. Yeah. And but back then, we had the luxury of going through a two-week program where they went through the systems just for 2 weeks, where we had a classroom where you had an instructor and they would teach us each system every day. And at the end of those 2 weeks, they would prep us for the oral, where would they give us mock orals for 4 or 5 hours, going over every switch, every light. What temperature does this come on? What valve opens here? All that stuff. So we were totally prepared for that oral and that systems. Nowadays, it's totally different because the airlines are trying to cut costs as much as they can. So they want to limit the amount of training on campus training that they do. So what they'll do is they'll give you a CD. Before, they'll tell you your training is scheduled for such and such a date, and about a month ahead of time they'll give you this, mainly the CD, and it's up to you to go through that CD and learn everything you can about this, not only the systems of the airplane, but they want you to memorize all the flows. I don't know, do you guys know what flows are?
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to do your pre-flight, your before start flows, your after start flows, your taxi flows, all those things. So have all those memorized, all your memory items memorized. So before you even go to the first day, you have to have all that done on your own. Then that first day you get into school and they give you a test on the computer where you have to pass that test on questions on all those systems and all those memory items, all the limitations, every limitation. And then you have to pass that in the first half hour that you're there. And then they start getting into the simulator, not the simulator, but the FTDs, flight training devices, and some of that stuff where they reinforce, make sure that you've got your flows down and that kind of thing. And then once you get into the simulator environment, every day, instead of training, it seems like it's more of a check ride than it's actual training. So it's very intense. So the benefit that you guys will have is that you're going to be prepared for that because you're going through intense training now. You're getting that kind of exposure to those FTDs and those simulators where you're actually sitting in a RJ, where you're going through your flows. You're learning how to do go arounds and flying approaches and stuff. And yeah, and you'd have a huge benefit, a huge advantage.
Yeah, I can't imagine the Part 61 just going from like a 172 with a couple buttons up top straight to hydraulics and pneumatic systems, just like what you kind of had to go through.
Yeah, well, the only way I did it was I memorized the books.
Yeah.
We had these huge three ring binder books that were about 5 inches thick a piece. And I didn't know what I was reading. I had no idea. I couldn't comprehend all that stuff, but I started memorizing it. And I would just memorize. And finally I got to the point where some of that stuff started to sink in and eventually figured it out.
Yeah, that sounds like such a grind. I don't think I've ever memorized a book front to back.
Yeah, that'd be crazy.
But I think that that the last thing we were talking about, how UND's training will translate well to airline training, could be really good motivation for students, because that's kind of what this podcast is geared towards, is new UND students or new flight students just trying to keep their nose to the grindstone and make it to the airlines. But would you have any other types of advice for like new flight students in today's training environment?
Well, just be there for the right reasons. If you're, don't, like any career, don't do it because your mom and dad want you to be there, because they think this is a good career for you. Do it because you want to be there. Because when I took that first flight lessons, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So that gave me the motivation to study. It wasn't a chore for me. I enjoyed it. The more I learned, the better I liked it. So that was motivation enough for me. I love flying and I love learning. The more gauges and the more switches an airplane had, the more I liked it.
Nice.
All right. Yeah. Awesome. And I just want to toss this out there. Rob, you totally helped give the aviation bug to me by taking me up in the 185. And I really appreciated that opportunity. And I think that was awesome. I hope that I can give back to people like that someday.
Yeah. So, well, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, Rob, that was all that we had with you. Is there any other last little tips and advice you'd give anybody?
No, not really. I just, I enjoy seeing the new generation coming up like you guys. It's, I don't have any doubt that we're handing it over to a great bunch of guys and gals in the future. You know, you guys are a lot more knowledgeable than I ever was at that point. So I just, I think that you're going to do just super.
Sweet. Thank you so That's much for being know. On the podcast today, Rob.
Okay, guys. You take care.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed the podcast.
If you have any questions for us, DM us on Instagram @vertical_guidance.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.